This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Science Technology Society channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Francis, and I have with me today Professor Stefan Lauren Sordner, author of the new book, We Have Always Been Cyborgs. Welcome to the podcast, Stefan.
Many thanks for that kind introduction.
So I thought we could start off talking about the name of the book, because it's a really fascinating name to me. Why did you choose this as the name of your book, We Have Always Been Cyborgs? What is a cyborg?
Well, the cyborg, actually, sort of when you talk about the cyborg etymologically, cyborg comes from kubernetes, which is an ancient Greek term, and it means helmsman, the steers person of a ship. So a cyborg means a steered orc, meaning organism, a steered organism. And so by means of that title, I was able to capture two elements, which I'm trying to present. One, which is sort of a way of taking on some elements of critical posthumanism, Donna Haraway, Catherine Hales, and so on. And another element is some elements of transhumanism, which I'm trying to present. Sort of on the one hand, it's about talking about the ethics of enhancement. On the other hand, it's talking about a revised anthropology. And I'm embracing both elements. And I actually think, sort of, even though very often critical posthumanism and transhumanism are seen as hostile towards each other, I think they're actually much more closely related than what they both recognize. And we've always been cyborgs. So the cyborg is a steered organism. And steering begins when we learn language. Sort of right after birth, we don't speak any language. What happens then is sort of our parents come up to us, our environment, and they upgrade us. They teach us. They make us learn language. And then we go to school and we study mathematics and physics and history. And then these are further upgrading procedures. So traditionally, in the entire Western tradition, language learning had to do with possessing a rational soul. And the explanation for why we stand out among all the other entities in the world is that because we do have a rational soul. So language is not an acquisition. Language was not seen as an upgrade. Language was seen as something which we received from God. According to the Catholic Church, that happened directly during fertilization, when the rational soul is something immaterial, gets connected to our material body, the fertilized egg. And so by stressing that we've always been cyborgs, I'm presenting that has been become implausible after Darwin, that basically that something immaterial sort of gets connected to something material, but rather that it's a dynamic process. We've acquired language. This is how we become speaking rational beings. But rationality, as a consequence, obviously, is not such a unified rationality as we used to believe in. However, it is something, because each rationality is different, because each of our cultural, all of our cultural circumstances, all of our upgrading processes have been different. That's why there's a slight difference. It's not a unified, eternal, immaterial rationality, but rationality has come, is an embodied rationality. It has come about as part of educational procedures, and it permanently gets altered by means of further technologies, by means of other applications, also like gene technologies, digitalization, brain-computer interfaces. And this is sort of the way to connect, on the one hand, a revised anthropology, a revised understanding of ourselves. But on the other hand, I can also talk about, and that has enormous implications also concerning how the ethics of emerging technologies, how we should deal with all the great challenges like CRISPR-Cas9, gene editing, and brain-computer interfaces with which we are currently confronted.
So is rationality itself a technology?
Exactly. And this is the important thing. So rationality being a technology, that also has implications that it's a technology shouldn't just be seen as a means. It's not a functional understanding of rationality or of language. So, of course, one aspect of, you know, why have a hammer is, you know, it's got a specific purpose. But on the other hand, it also alters who we are and our being in the world. So by means of rationality, by means of having language, I'm able to communicate. If I sort of leave, go out of John Cabot University, go into the next coffee bar, and then order a coffee, then I manage to get a coffee. I manage to communicate my strong desire to have an espresso. And that works. So as a means, language works as a tool. But at the same time, rationality has become part of who I am. It is part of my dynamic, contingent, nodal point of my existence in the world. So it's no, that's a further implication. So it's no longer something immaterial. It's no longer its essence, which permanently remains the same. But each interaction, each further movement, everything alters who we are, and thereby also alters the understanding of rationality. And so it's a revised understanding of technology as just being a means, and it takes seriously the notion that technology, or here rationality, gets integrated into the being in the world, and the being, and that shows why the words are so, or can be, misleading, because it's not a being, it's not an essence which I am, but it's a permanent becoming, it's a permanent modification. Each little moment directly alters who I am, alters my own rationality. And so, yes, rationality is a technology, but one shouldn't misunderstand technologies as by solely having means or a functional understanding of rationality in mind.
And that also plays into probably the duality that we oftentimes draw between nature and culture. Technology is not necessarily something that stands apart from and stands even in opposition to our natural state.
Exactly. And so, yes, this is part also of the revised understanding of who we are, that sort of our nature culture understanding is highly implausible. And this is something we've inherited from a longstanding Platonic Christian tradition. Yeah, it goes back to the Plato's cave, where they highlighted sort of the distinction between the good as being identical to the sun, to the immaterial sun, to rationality, and sort of us being in the world of change, us being in the darkness. And sort of such a dualistic understanding is no longer plausible, and that needs to be taken into consideration when thinking about anthropology and ethics today. And thereby, by taking these problematic dualities into consideration, it's also a way of moving away from all the types of discrimination which go along with these dualities. And it's very good to demonstrate which problematic structures have come about as a consequence of these dualities. So just looking back to Plato's cave, we see here the sort of the sun as being rationality, as being the good in itself. So here, the sun is bright and we are in the darkness. So here we see brightness as being good, darkness as being bad. This is racism already being in the, in our, as being part of our encrusted structures of our cultures. Furthermore, we see rationality as being, the sun being rationality, our bodies being our emotionality being away from rationality. Rationality is traditionally being identified with man, the body's emotions with women. Here we see sexism as being part of this longstanding cultural history. Furthermore, rationality is something which has traditionally been held only by human beings. Others, non-human beings, simply couldn't possess rationality. They were solely material entities. You can still find that in Descartes. You can still find that in Kant. You can still find this understanding in most foundational laws all over the world. It's only humans who are persons. Animals are things or are supposed to be treated like things. And that again goes back to this dualistic understanding where it's humans who possess rationality. All non-humans don't have that capacity. And so here we see all the great diversity of discriminatory structures, which is founded in our Western cultural background. And there are only very few thinkers who've managed to move beyond, who've created a twist, moving away from these categorical dualities like Heraclitus, like Spinoza, like Nietzsche. And so by drawing upon their understandings, their ways of thinking, and combining it also with transhumanism, I'm developing a new philosophically enhanced version, also a philosophically proper philosophy of transhumanism, which is what I'm presenting in this book.
Can you talk a little bit about the idea of transhumanism? Where does that idea come from?
So we've got the word transhumanare actually can already be found in Dante's Inferno. However, so it seems that he has actually coined the term. However, then that referred to some immaterial alteration in some other world, and it has nothing really to do with what transhumanism stands for in our days. Transhumanism then as a concept was coined in 1951 by Julian Huxley. And he's actually presented an understanding of transhumanism, which is still plausible today. And he also coined the term of evolutionary humanism. So evolutionary humanism and transhumanism are closely related terms in a book, New Bottles for a New Wine from 1957. He used both of these terms. And there were other thinkers. A friend of his was Théâtre de Chandon, who also talked about transhumanizing. So it was in these circles where the term came up, and Julian Huxley was the one who actually properly coined it. Then afterwards, in the 70s and in the end of the 80s, it really turned into a proper movement. And FM 2030 and Max Moore, Natasha Vita Moore, they were decisive and in formulating the term in developing a contemporary understanding of transhumanism. Then it developed into a movement. And then at the beginning, around 2000, suddenly, there were intellectuals like Jürgen Habermas, one of, the world-leading philosophers of our times. And he was reacting to a presentation by Peter Sloterdijk, who gave a talk entitled Rules for the Human Zoo, in which he talked about, well, post and transhumanism, in which he talked about the necessity to develop laws concerning genetic modification. And Habermas suddenly replied to this, oh, these are all, neo-Nietzschean fantasies. They're new breeding fantasies relating to a fascist understanding. And so this is where the entire debate concerning transhumanism within academic circles actually started to take place. Then more and more intellectuals started to take seriously transhumanism as a movement. But even in the beginning of the 2000s, it didn't really get dealt with properly in most academia. Most professors still don't know what it stand, the notion stands for. Then suddenly, in between 2010 and now, then it really became a mass phenomena. People like Dan Brown's Inferno, he actually talked about transhumanism. He mentioned World Transhumanist Association. He referred to FM 2030. The entire plot was a transhumanist plot. Transcendence, the movie with Johnny Depp, it was about mind uploading, one element of transhumanism. Then sort of the Big Bang Theory talked a lot about transhumanism. And it came up in lots of Netflix series. Altered Carbon, Black Mirror is just an amazing series. So here you find that really in the cultural fear, more and more people talking about it. But actually what is interesting, still they talk about the phenomena, but sort of still the notion of transhumanism is still not so well known among many educated people. Even though even the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, he self-identifies as a transhumanist and many others in Silicon Valley. So this is a sort of a short summary, a short history of transhumanism. And nowadays, as a consequence of all the, you know, in particular what's happening with AI, with Neuralink, brain-computer interfaces, with genome editing, now more and more people realize that all of this is rooted in a post-human paradigm shift, in a new understanding of who we are and how we relate to the world. And that's opening up an enormous amount of possibilities.
So how do you understand transhumanism? How would you define it?
So transhumanism is about an affirmation of new technologies in order to move beyond our current limitation. That's all there is. Does that mean it is just sufficient, you know, to being a transhuman, a posthuman, if you break the world record in high jumping? Well, not necessarily, because sort of the way it as it is defined, it is sort of we need to significantly move beyond our current limitations. And there are different notions of the post-human. The most radical one is sort of the one which is being talked about in Silicon Valley very often. Kurzweil and Elon Musk deal with it. And so it's about mind uploading. It's about a continued existence somewhere on a hard drive. I'm very hesitant. I don't regard that as, I don't think this will happen in the next decades. I don't regard any pressing current issue as being related to this. However, it's sort of many people simply get extremely excited about it and fascinated and talk about it, and it's being dealt with in loads of Netflix series. So that's why people get fascinated by it, but I don't think it is connected to any really pressing current issue we need to be confronted with. And then there are other cases, and the other option would be sort of establishing brain-computer interfaces and having the possibility of also breaking away from our current species, sort of the post-human as a member of a new species, as a further development, evolutionary development. And that's becoming much more likely. That's a much more realistic notion. And the third understanding of post-human, it's simply you still remain a human being, but you move significantly move beyond the capacities currently living human beings possess. So basically, if we possess the same smelling capacities as a shark, then we would definitely be post-human. And these are various elements of what the post-human can stand for. And within transhumanism, there's a heated debate, sort of what is supposed to be the proper understanding. But the decisive issue, all of the technological innovations are being addressed, which we're currently facing, and we need to find a solution for them. And so it's really enables us to have a debate on the ethics of emerging technologies on a revised understanding of who we are as human beings, meaning that we don't have an eternal natural essence, but we are part of the evolutionary world. There's only a gradual difference between us and other non-human animals. And that has significant implications for how issues concerning norms and values should apply in this sector.
So what are some of the contemporary technologies that we already have right now that you might classify as transhumanist?
I mean, the technologies we in transhumanist debates, all the great variety of technologies are being addressed, and sort of whatever helps us to achieve the goal of moving beyond the limitations, that is a, you know, this is a praiseworthy, that's an important technology. And one could ask, yeah, why should we move beyond our current limitations? Well, because in the past, we've realized that by doing so, we're significantly increasing the likelihood of us living a good life. And that's a basic motivation. We all want to live a good life. And by using these technologies, we increase our likelihood of doing so. And this comes out best, I guess, with respect to health technologies. So in the past 200, just looking back, the past 200 years, we can see we've doubled our life expectancy all over the world. And that's just a wonderful achievement. And it's not just our life expectancy, it's actually our quality of life has increased significantly. Sort of, and that's why transhumanists prefer to talk about the importance of an increased health span rather than the importance of an increased lifespan. Because what we're interested in is not just living longer. We don't want to, you know, normally, most people don't want to, you know, stay in bed, unable to move for 80 years from the age of 80 to 160. That's not normally in most people's interest. But however, if one lives longer, one lives longer healthily, then that makes an enormous difference. And so the one thing most transhumanists can actually, or most transhumanists affirm is that an increased health span is indeed in some way relevant to our quality of life. You know, we all have different notions of what the good life is, and that's, it's important. And the transhumanists do take into consideration that there's just a great diversity of different understandings of what the good life stands for. However, what most transhumanists agree upon is sort of an increased health span is what most people identify with an increased quality of life. And this is something which should be taken seriously. And any technology which basically enables us to have an increased health span would be such a transhumanist technology.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the book, you mention silicon and carbon-based technologies. Can you give a little overview of some of those technologies that we're seeing come into fruition now?
Yeah, so I make the distinction between a silicon-based transhumanism and a carbonate-based transhumanism, and so and many in also in public media, when transhumanism is talked about, they merely talk about a silicon-based transhumanism, and they often do so in order to make fun of transhumanism, because sort of in particular, sort of in academia, sort of if you talk about transhumanism, it's just about a bunch of young men who've been sitting in front of the computer for too long, and they just want to be turned into Superman on Viagra or Wonder Woman on Botox, and then eventually get uploaded onto a hard drive and then become immortal in this manner. That's sort of the standard narrative in order to make fun of transhumanism by highlighting, you know, all transhumanists really ought to have that goal in mind, you know, getting uploaded into a hard drive. And this is sort of a silicon-based transhumanism is about putting your personality onto a hard drive and digitalizing your personality. And that could happen in different manners. I mean, you could actually, normally sort of one of the options is establishing a brain-computer interface and then realizing some way of transferring the functions of your brain onto a computer would be one way of realizing that upgrading process. There's possibility of maybe of copying your personality onto a hard drive. Another option is we create a digital entity, a living digital entity, which then evolves further and then thus comes about with maybe self-consciousness, with super intelligence and so on. So it's independent. It's just created, initially stimulated by humans. All of these developments, I'm not excluding these possibilities of the possibilities of such developments. However, it's we don't even have any living digital entity. You know, so far, if we talk about, you know, in order for all of these developments to occur, the minimum we would need is to be alive and to be digital. And if you ask some people, even like Stephen Hawking, he said, we do actually have some living digital entities. And he said, a computer virus is a living digital entity. That doesn't really fulfill all the prerequisites of what we identify, of what it means to being alive, because it's self-moving. It's passing itself on from entity to entity via the internet. However, the virus cannot sustain itself. Doesn't manage to get energy by itself. So, and thereby it lacks a significant element of what we identify with being alive. And the same applies to organic, non-silicon-based viruses either. So that's why a normal, like the COVID virus, is also not a living entity. So the same applies in both respects. The carbonate-based transhumanism, on the other hand, they are interested. So carbonate-based transhumanism is about moving beyond our current limitations as human beings. And maybe you still remain as a human being but basically have the capacity, you know, of hearing, perceiving infrared lights, smelling much better like sharks. Or having the possibility of suddenly having an increased health span by 30 more years. This would be, you know, significant steps away. Maybe that would be sufficient also for regarding us to being turned into another species. If we then are unable to sexually procreate with other human beings, then that would count as a necessary criterion for them no longer being regarded as human beings. So it's about the sexual reproduction. However, once all of these possibilities come about, sexual reproduction might not even be the most significant aspect for reproduction anymore, because we're currently sort of disentangling sexuality from reproduction. And we've been doing that for quite a while. So that is also an important element of that carbonate-based transhumanism. So we started to deal with condoms, with the pill, with in vitro fertilization, and so on. And now we've already developed the biobag for sheep, for lamb. It's like an artificial uterus, and we've managed to realize that already, so that a lamb can be born in such an artificial uterus. And various scientists all over the world are working on a possibility of realizing such an artificial uterus for human beings. In Netherlands, they've been investing a lot of money in order to actually bring that about. And so that would be a possibility. So on the one hand, sex being for entertainment and technology is being used for reproductive purposes. So that would make an enormous difference. Maybe it also could be a way of supporting gender equality in the workplace. Whatever, you know, it shouldn't be necessary, but maybe it helps by then there not being a need for getting pregnant anymore. It might even be safer for the child being stored in a safer environment. So we will see. This is all, you know, this is But these are things we're already working on, and we've already established, and they work with lamps. So when carbonate-based transhumanists talk about issues, it's all about stuff where here we can see examples which already work. So it's not about pure science fiction. It's actually we've got a good indication that something works in other species. It's just a matter of transferring the same technologies onto humans. I know, for example, a couple of scientists in the Netherlands who've created genetically engineered zebrafishes, and these zebrafishes have the possibility of photosynthesis. So they managed to get 20% of their energy by means of the sunlight. As a consequence, they turn green. So you've got green solar powered zebrafishes. That's a really fascinating technology. So if we managed to achieve that on humans, no one would have to die of hunger anymore. Or if we fly to Mars, to another planet, you know, the question of how to deal with nutritional issues would be solved. Anyway, so here we can see examples. This is working on fishes. Obviously that's not so easy, but you know, there's a good chance that the same procedure also works on human beings. And these would be examples of technologies concerning a carbonate-based transhumanism, in particular related to gene technologies, CRISPR-Cas9. And there's such an enormous potential which goes along with that specific technology, which could enable us to live much longer and better and healthier. And that's why I think this carbonate-based transhumanism is something which I'm strongly supporting. And I think this is something which we should take seriously also politically, because most people identify a longer life, a longer and healthier life with a better quality of life, no matter what else they identify with a good life. But living longer and healthier is the one thing which is important to most people.
So I was really intrigued by your talk about gene modification in the book. One question that I had is it doesn't seem to me that the problem or the tension with these technologies is that they're unnatural. I totally agree with you that within a cyborgian understanding of the history of humanity, technology is not, it's the concern with it doesn't have to be that they're unnatural. But my question is, I'm wondering if they'll actually have the opposite problem maybe, which is that they'll serve to reinforce ideas about what is naturally good. For example, if you can select to have a higher IQ, to be faster, to be stronger, to live longer, won't those traits, having a higher IQ, even like being skinnier or something, if parents can select that for their offspring, won't those traits be even further reinforced as the ones that are desirable if the socioeconomically elite are the ones that are selecting for them? Won't those traits be further codified as this is the good? And if those technologies are only available to the socioeconomically elite, because technologies are always expensive, I would assume that only those who can afford them are going to be able to get them. Won't that just continue to create a further chasm between the haves and have-nots?
Yeah, you're right with your worry. I think this is one of the significant challenges, but it's also one which is taken care of or which is being discussed intensely within the transhumanist circles. So it would be false to solely identify transhumanism with these libertarian Silicon Valley transhumanists who just focus on freedom, and that would lead to a hierarchy in the world, which exactly a vision which you have in mind, which you've just presented. And that would be extremely dangerous. And I perfectly agree with you, because it would probably have the consequences you are mentioning, because in that case, it does undermine a central achievement of the enlightenment process, namely freedom. So if we just focus on freedom, then we end up with a hierarchy of the haves and have-nots, which undermines, which takes away the freedom of the have-nots, because they are implicitly forced, or maybe even explicitly forced, to do something they don't want to do. And that's why a libertarian version is not a proper understanding of freedom. A proper understanding of freedom needs to take into consideration that a too strong hierarchy undermines freedom itself. And then other elements need to become relevant. For example, the element that in order to be free, you also need to be healthy. Being healthy is you know, a prerequisite for the achievement of freedom. And as a consequence of that, you would need a universal health insurance. And that's something which is an issue in the United States. I mean, I think that's one of the most challenging elements of living in the United States, that because that there is no universal health insurance, and that is actually not as I stressed, that it undermines a proper understanding of freedom, and so any such state which takes this understanding of freedom seriously would have to make sure health is being covered. And then you need to deal with what actually does that imply. And there are many different notions of health. And it always depends on the financing concerning how good your health insurances are. And even though here in Europe we have, there is a universal health insurance in the European Union, in all the countries of the European Union, but obviously there's an enormous difference between what the health insurance in Germany offers to the health insurance in Italy, and again to the health insurance in Bulgaria, because it depends on the financial background. So we need to make sure that sort of a health insurance, a decent health insurance, is actually financed and supported by a social liberal democratic government. And it's an issue even in a country like Italy and Bulgaria, where we do have a national health insurance. There are certain surgeries which are only offered in private practices in Italy, which are being covered and as part of the public health insurance in Germany, just to give, this is just one example that this is a case. And that's a challenge. And that's why, and I think that's, money is needed in order to finance these public health insurance. And the question is, where do we get the money from? And sort of as part of the book, I made the suggestion that we do need to use our digital data in order to finance the public health insurance system, and that we shouldn't give away the digital data to the big companies, to the big digital players, companies, to Google and Facebook, because they're just using it for their own interest, for their own, that the CEOs and administrators get richer and richer. And we shouldn't give it sort of to China or to any type of more authoritarian structure either, because they're just using it to uphold their own political structures. So we need to find a proper liberal, social liberal, democratic way of using personalized digital data democratically. And that is not so easy, but we need to use the data. And the problem is, Europe is currently focusing on protecting privacy. And I fully understand the value of privacy. And I'm extremely scared of giving up, of moving away from these structures, from cherishing privacy. However, given the relevance of personalized digital data, I think there is a practical necessity to do so. And in the end, that's why in the book I suggested a structure, how we can achieve a system, a liberal democratic system, where the personalized digital data are being collected by a liberal government. Because I have, in the end, the question is, so we need personalized digital data because data is the new oil, as is widely being shared in by economists. We need the data for our health purposes, for policy making, for innovation, for research in the social sciences, in the natural sciences. It's enormously important. So the way digital data are being treated in Europe is not in the European interest. If we continue to do so, it will be, we will not be able to uphold the social insurance system which we currently have in Europe, because the money simply goes away to countries who make use of the personalized digital data. So we need to find a way of an institution collecting the data and using it in a democratic interest. And the question is, what is a democratic interest? And the democratic interest, on the basis of a liberal understanding, that where each one of us has a different understanding of the good life, well, we focus on what is being shared by most people. And most people identify an increased health span with a better quality of life. So by giving the way the data, personalized digital data, away to such an institution, a political institution, and using it then in order to finance the public health insurance, is sort of my suggestion of finding an alternative in between the libertarian US-American version and the authoritarian Chinese version. Obviously, much more would have to be said, but that is sort of the basic logic which I'm presenting as part of the book. This is a way, sort of, because health is a fundamental element for of freedom, and freedom is not just absence of constraint. There's more to it. There's health. There's also social justice. A certain type of equality is important, and so we need to find a different way of realizing it. So my response, the important response is, well, there is a problem. But it's a political problem. It's got to do with the libertarian structures and not with transhumanism. It's got to do with the political circumstances. And I'm outlining a sketch of some political circumstances where we could benefit of the developments of emerging technologies, but such that they're in a democratic interest.
I think that is a perfect response. So Stefan, we are running out of time now on our meeting. I would just like to ask you before we go, you have so many interesting thoughts and ideas. Is there anything else that people can read that you've written recently or that is about to come out?
So I've got a general introduction on transhumanism, which came out with Penn State University Press in 2020, that was translated from the German. Then in 2022, we've always been cyborgs, in which I sort of deal with all the ethics and the philosophy of transhumanism. And then a couple of months later, the book came out, Philosophy of Posthuman Art, in which I address all the implications concerning emerging technologies on the field of the arts. And that's coming out as a paperback in September. That's already been out as a hardback, but in September it will be out as a cheap paperback. Philosophy of Posthuman Art. It gives an additional aspect. I completely talk, solely the field of arts and the connections also to religion, technology, the arts. And so that might be of interest to some who enjoy that book.
Well, I'm excited to read it.
And maybe, well, just one further thing is, in 2017, I established the world's first journal explicitly dedicated to the posthuman. So because normally the response was in academic circles when I talked about transhumanism and posthumanism and metahumanism, and then the response, well, is there any academic journal? Because if there's no academic journal, it's not a praiseworthy, it's not an academic enterprise. So it took us about 4 years in order to get it done, because it's not just a simple peer review process for getting an article published, but actually, you establish a new field of studies. Posthuman studies didn't exist before. So we established the Journal of Posthuman Studies in cooperation with Penn State University Press. It was launched in 2017 in the editorial board. You find leading representatives from both the critical posthumanists, from the transhumanist side, from Karen Barat, Catherine Hales, Julian Savulescu. You find artists like Kach and Stellark. You find ethicists like Luciano Floridi, Julian Savulescu. You find philosophers Gianni Vattimo, Wolfgang Welsch. It's an enormous range of really illustrious intellectuals who supported that project, all the leading authorities in the field. And so we've got, and that's a double-blind peer-reviewed journal. journal. It is listed in Scopus. It's progressing as an academic field, and it's available online as well as in print. And as a consequence of that journal, and now we took it one step further, I'm offering a course on post-human studies at John Cabot University, and in cooperation with IVA University, we're trying to establish post-human studies further in academia. So at IVA Women's University in Seoul, which is one of the best universities in South Korea, they are now offering an MA and PhD program dedicated to post-human studies. So if you want to write a doctoral thesis dedicated to the episode Nose Dive in Black Mirror and how it relates to the Chinese social credit system, you can do so as part of that PhD program at IVA University. So we see it's really developing. It's enormously fascinating and thrilling to be part of such a cultural movement of the post-human paradigm shift, moving away from this dualistic discriminatory structures of the past.
Thank you so much, Stefan.
Thanks a lot for your wonderful interview.